Lynch and I watched a movie last night called 49 Up, which is a series of documentaries about a group of children who were filmed every 7 years, from the age of 7 to the age of now 49. And the premise of the movie was a statement, and I forget who said it, "Show me a child until the age of 7 and I will show you the man or the woman." That somehow the person we are by the age of 7 is essentially who we're going to be our whole life. And of course, it's quite fascinating, but the film seems to affirm that. That each of these kids grew up to be, in some very fundamental way, who they already were. The hardest part about watching the film is watching the one thing that disappears from all of these children, and that is their wide-eyed innocence, their sense of unbelievable hope in the future, their complete unawareness of how demanding and rigorous life will be. They are so clear-eyed, so full of possibility. And then you watch every 7 years how, in a certain sense, this life is drained out of them. So many of them had dreams as children that they fulfilled, and expectations. One 8-year-old said he would be a barrister when he grew up, and he was a barrister when he grew up. This is all in England. One guy wanted to be a cab driver, he was a cab driver. The women all wanted to be married, all married. And it's so fascinating to watch where their joy came from. Many of their relationships ended in divorce. Some did not. Some continued and went through many trials and tribulations. Nobody seemed to get through their lives without trials and tribulations. And almost universally, they hated the fact that they were part of this movie experiment. They hated that somebody came every 7 years to examine their lives. They just hated, one, the fact that they had to bring up all of the issues of their lives for the public, but even more problematic, I think, for themselves. Because, in a sense, they became examined lives. And the old adage, the unexamined life isn't worth living, well, these guys are being forced into that examination. Forced in a very public way to explore their successes and failures, and quite clearly, they had both. The most clearly fascinating part to me was where their joy seemed to come from. And it was pretty universal. The joy in their lives came from family, came from connection, came from other people. That was their joy. What I would call communion. The sense of being around life, being around, not work. None of them seemed very happy at work, almost across the board, just a few. Most of them, work had lost its allure. But what worked for them was connectivity, this exchange between them and either one other or groups of others. And that's what kept everybody going. Interesting for me that almost all of them still were looking to the future as a place of fulfillment. Even the ones who were in the moment most fulfilled were looking to the future. And you could sort of feel in them the human ignorance of always looking past what was for what might become, or past what is for what might be. The happiest of them still thought down the road it will be happy. And you could tell, you've got it right now. It's right there. You could see this one guy playing with his grandchildren on the beach. He was a cab driver. All these kids and people running around in a little house he had bought in Spain. And you're looking and you're going, this is a lucky man. This is a lucky guy. He just nose to the grindstone, lived his life, and yet he had joy in his life. And yet he was thinking the future will bring more joy. Well, in fact, maybe it will bring more joy. But the true joy of his moment was so palpable and so beautiful. And what you sensed in so many of these people was that they were never aware of the joy in the moment. They were always projecting it down the road. They were always waiting for it to arrive and therefore missing it over and over and over. And it was, in a sense, sad because you wanted to take them for a moment and just go, hey, you still are that child. You still are that innocent being. That person is still alive in you. It's just so layered upon layered with all of the disappointments of life and the frustrations and the insecurities and the fears and all these things that come into everybody's life. You looked at these people and you just said, feel yourself. Feel your own being. Feel who you are. They were all people who had lost touch. They had lost touch in some way with their own core being. Not that it wasn't there, especially the cab driver, who I think was the happiest of these people. He was still full of life. He just wasn't aware of how full of life he was. He just didn't quite get it. And you just wanted to say, stop and get a snapshot of yourself in this moment. You have it. You are it. And in a way, that's what the Zen teaching is. It's like to go, look at this. This is what it is. But our culture so drives us toward finding it down the road that we hardly ever see it when we have it. And it's one of the great sadnesses of our sort of Western society, that it is a constant titillation to the next thing. The iPhone. If this is going to finally give us our true happiness, And you're just waiting for the newspaper next week to talk about all the problems with the iPhone. And everybody's looking for something. And yet, if we had a snapshot of each of us in our childhood, in our first 7 years, in that kind of truly wide-eyed expectation of life, what we were really looking at, what we thought we were looking at as the future, was really that we were looking at the moment. As children, we were so alive in the moment. And you look at kids, the way they look at the world, it's not about the future, they're really looking at the present. They're really looking at what is. They're just looking at it and going, and they are bubbly. They are not self-condemning. They are not self-censoring, which is kind of fresh and wonderful. They say the most absurdly beautiful, simple, foolish little things, but you love them because there's nothing guarded in them. There's no sense that this is wrong to love these little kids loving each other. I love you. I want to marry you. They're so free in that expression. It's so sweet. And that is who we are. That's really who we are. And then we get made rigid by our lives. We get life squeezed out of us. And yet the truth is, as long as you're alive, that life is there. It's there. The fullness of life is there. But is it getting through? No. And why is it not getting through? Because we are cramped by our years and years of complicated choices, disappointments, misguided choices. So much gets in the way. And so here we are, midlife or past midlife, and we are squeezed out of our own joy, squeezed out of our own happiness. And how do you get unsqueezed? How do you get free of that horrible, horrible constriction that burdens most people? And you can see, when you look at people, I watch and I see where it's held. Some of you are holding it in your head, some it's in your heart, some is in your gut, some is in your shoulders. Everybody's sitting there with this squeezed, hard, tense feeling about their lives. And all you have to do, and it's so much simpler than anybody ever tells you, but all you have to do is step back and go, and feel what's really there. It's so there in us. It's so there, but the years and years and years of not paying attention have cost us the ability to recognize its presence. And presence is nothing other than being. Being. And that's what you're doing as we sit here right now. You are being. And the nature of being is what? Well, the teachings in the Hindu philosophy are that the nature of being is threefold. It's called Satchitananda, which is bliss, consciousness, bliss, and truth. These are the essences of being. And if you are conscious, meaning that you bring attention to this being, you discover, one, that it is blissful, meaning that it feels... I mean, bliss is the only word one knows to use for it, but it is so satisfying. It's so satisfying to be. Just to be. And this idea of truth is something to do with what I call self-evident nature. It's just self-evident. It is, there is nothing to contradict it. The mind can't contradict it. The body can't contradict it. It just is. It's this idea that I am. I am. There is no contradiction to that. All the teachings tell you that the I am this or that becomes complicated. I am happy. I am sad. Those are complicated because you may be happy in this moment, but that will change. You may be unhappy in this moment, but that will change. What doesn't change, at least as far as we know during the course of our life, is I am. I am. That's the truth. I am. It's irrefutable. You can argue everything else, but I am. You can say, I am this body, you know, but this body keeps changing. You know, I used to be a cute little kid, you know. Here I am. What can you say? But what happens is it changes. But the truth of my being has not changed at all. It's gotten overlaid with all sorts of stuff. But even that stuff has kept changing. But what hasn't changed is the underlying part of my being, which is constant and alive and as innocent to this day as those children in that movie. And when I let go of all of my stuff, which is a training, it's really training, you learn to let it go. You drop it off, and when you drop it off, there is this, it is an innocence. Now, I'm not saying that innocence doesn't partake of all of the experience of life. And if you watch children, they cry like that. They laugh like that. You can distract them from their sadness in a minute. You know, just turn them somewhere else. They can't have this toy, you give them that thing. And suddenly they've gone off into another world. The innocence of childhood is not devoid of emotion. It's not devoid of suffering. It's not devoid of the stuff of being. It's all part of that, but it is pure. It's just pure. And we are that. You can still have all of that emotionality in your life. You can still have all of the joy. You'll have all of the sadness, all of these things. But what you recognize after a while is this is life. This is life. But instead of seeing it as life with years and years of this is what it should be and this is what it could have been and all of the overlay, it's just the essence of life. Happy, sad, yearning, having, the sense of well-being, the sense of childhood getting up in the morning and going, this is great, this is great. I am alive. I'm here. I remember so vividly getting up in the morning and thinking, I have the whole day ahead of me. The whole day. It's like, oh my God, so I can do this and that and this and that. I also remember in the middle of that going to my mother, I have nothing to do. What do I do today? I'm so bored. I'm so bored. And I would suffer. I would suffer this boredom because I suddenly couldn't figure out what to do with the day. And she would go get like a coloring book and some crayons and said, here. I go, ah. And I would color. And I would, 2 hours would go by and I would fill the book with colorings and I would feel great. You know, it was like simple, immediate pleasure. Underlying that emotional purity of childhood awareness and being is something deeper. We can call it awareness. Just pure awareness. The part of us that is watching us be. That awareness, we are told, is infinite and eternal. If that's true or not true, we'll find out. But the experience of it is certainly an experience that feels as though it has always been there and will always be there. That awareness and consciousness of awareness appear to be timeless. There is no duration. There is no time. There is no hunger for time in it. There is no desire for time. It is completely satisfying in its absolute freedom from time and demand. It just is pure, essential awareness. We are told in spiritual teachings that this is our true self. This is who we are. That everything else comes and goes, including our name, our form, our body, our whole history, comes and goes. But this awareness, we are told, is forever. If I'm wrong, I'm wrong. But if I'm right, you can touch that awareness even as I speak. You can be aware that you're actually sitting here in this room listening to this guy talk. You can be aware that you are in this world, that you are in this body, that you are in this mind. You are definitely aware that you are. It's the one thing that is true and absolutely irreversible, that irrefutable, that you are. And this sense of being is pervasive and renewing. And its renewing aspect is the most important part of spiritual practice, because you can go back to or become aware of your awareness, your pure awareness, and every time you touch that awareness, you become like a child again. You become innocent again. You become revived in your being. You come back to life, literally bringing back awareness. And this awareness fills you. It floods your being. It uplifts you. It ennobles you. It gives you purpose. It gives you this wide-eyed innocence that you came into the world with. And you can have that even in your 50s and in your 60s and in your 70s. You can have it anytime you want it. All you have to do is sit back and be aware. And to be aware, all you have to do is get quiet. That's all you have to do. And as I explained to you today in the introductory class, that's not so easy for a lot of people. Getting quiet takes practice. Getting quiet means sitting through your boredom, sitting through your distraction. You know, a lot of you sit down to get quiet and all you want to do is go to sleep. You know, it's because it's the only cue you're used to. Quiet means sleep, unconsciousness. Well, I'm saying just the opposite. Sit down, be quiet, and be conscious. Wake up. Wake up. Don't go to sleep. Don't get into your kind of mind sort of noise. Wake up to stillness. And if you wake up to stillness, what you will experience is a revival of you, a reawakening of your childlike nature, and you will come into a kind of childlike joy in your day-to-day life that for most people gets winnowed away into a kind of awful, unpleasant day-to-day existence. You don't have to live that way. That's the nature of spiritual work. It's revival. It's the revival of you, the revival of yourself, the revival of your energy. And it's a rare event. That movie showed me how few people were able to revive it. It was very interesting. I saw the grandchildren seem to revive it temporarily. It's kind of tapping into new life. And you can, those of you who don't have grandchildren, me included, can draw from any child on the planet. Make them your grandchildren. Draw that energy from others, or, in the simplest way, draw it from your own child, yourself. You're still that child. Draw that energy up, and you will be filled with grandchildren internally. And you will be bouncing something on your knee for the rest of your life. You will find the joy of renewal as your own source. It doesn't have to come from anyone else. It's yours if you ask for it. It'll be interesting to watch that film when they're all 56. Be very curious to see who they are and if they continue to do this, because the life journey is one of the great mysteries, and nobody's ever documented people growing up from the age of 7 to this age on film. So you have to kind of watch it with a very open, very available awareness, because it's so instructive. But mostly what it looks like is just life. It's little depressing. You know, you just go, oh, it's just like everybody's life. But if you look at it really deeply, it's a profound teacher. The great teaching, as Rudy always said, is life, your life and everyone else's. Watch it deeply and you'll learn everything you need to know about your own existence and why it's worth sitting quietly to be observant. So, any questions today? Ted?
Maybe you're meaning more in a metaphorical way, but I kind of have a problem with over-idealizing the sort of childhood state. I was a child.
Right, right.
I played with many children and I was deeply suffering, and just like you were talking about the iPhone, there's always something you want that's going to make it some new toy. You know, there's always some grasping. It's almost impossible to sit still and quietly. You know, there's just, I think it's almost can be a deeper suffering than when you're older. You know, things might be more vivid and colorful. Your elemental energy might be more vibrant in a certain way. But I see that as kind of like part of the life cycle. You know, like,
right.
We're going to be children again, potentially, if your incarnation is correct. It's not, like, to me, it's not something to over-idealize.
Right. Let me metaphoricalize it.
Okay.
Being a child, and I'm talking even, you know, a newborn is suffering in the same way that a fully born person suffers. Life is life. Life is, Buddha got it right, it's suffering. You know, it's suffering with a kind of constant reaching for something, for this joy, for this possibility. But I have to say, in childhood and in those moments, I knew you as a child, and I saw into your eyes as a child, I vividly remember, that there was this glow. there was this really beautiful glow. And I
weren't there in the middle of the night when I was crying.
No, I wasn't. But I do know that there is in the childhood state something that tends to get kind of obliterated for most people as they get older. And it's not that you don't suffer, and it's not that life isn't hard, because it is for every being at every level. It's all basically the same. But the hint that we get in childhood, that I remember from my childhood, of having certain days that were untrammeled by knowledge. They were full of expectation. They weren't weighted down by disappointment yet. There was still this huge flowering of openness and possibility. That taste is the taste of spiritual awakening. It is. It's as close as I can describe it.
I think my acid trip experiences maybe were better than my childhood experience.
That may be. Whatever it is that finally releases you from the density and the drudgery of day-to-day wakened consciousness. It's hard being in the world, because here are these extraordinarily rarefied spirits, if you will, being pummeled by the forces of materialism, and it's hard to work through that. On the other hand, there seems to be a reason that we are called upon to maintain that, if you will, upliftment, effervescence, liveliness, aliveness, presence in the midst of all of this. And the fact that it's doable, the fact that it is possible, is to me an amazing thing. The fact that so few people do it is also kind of amazing. But there are lessons and there are messengers throughout history telling us there is something to be done here. That you don't have to be caught in the vice of human experience. That somehow through that squeezing you can find transcendence. That suffering in that space is a kind of choice. And that suffering is something that you can find a way to release yourself from. But it seems to be that you have to go through the suffering to find release. Through the fire rather than away from the fire. You have to find something calling you. And one of the few things that calls people, and not all of us, but is this childlike memory of something innocent and pure that you have at moments, that is something you don't tend to have after the age of 7. It tends to get washed away. There's some people who say that you come into this life completely sort of pure and free, and then by the age of 8, all of your old karma from past lives starts to unfold. And so for that first 7 years, there's a kind of a clean slate, clean being that, you know, you're still a person in the world with the demands of the world. But at the age of 8, it's like all the old stuff starts to come in. And that's when life starts to get tough for a lot of people in a whole other way. But all I can tell you is that childhood is it does reveal the man. That's one of the fascinating things, and I would say, knowing you from a child to who you are today, you are a flowering of that being. You are Daniel Subkoff is the Daniel Subkoff I knew when you were 6 years old. You know, there's that same person.
Maybe
is there. You were pretty articulate. Your longings, I think, were pretty clear, but now I think they're very, very focused. I think you know who you are and what you want out of life. And that's, for me, I mean, that's one of the great joys of adulthood. You know, you finally come to a place of, you know, of some people anyway, of knowing what doesn't work, what they don't want. And they start to get a sense of what they do want. And, you know, that's part of our journey. Unfortunately, a lot of us think the thing we want, we don't get it for 20 years, and we get it, it's not the thing we wanted. Then you go, oh no. then you have a problem, George.
Where does hope come into all this? I mean, you know, like you talk about the iPhone, which is, you know, right. Basically we're always looking or hoping for something to make our lives better. And is hope a bad thing, or is it something we should abandon in our life in that sense?
Can I ask a second part to that same question? Because that was something I was about to ask too, in the Buddhist context. It's often like a sort of the idea is to get to a state beyond hope and fear. And also childhood seems like kind of the quintessential state of hope and fear in a lot of ways, in my experience. So.
Okay. I think what Daniel's saying is important, the idea of getting beyond hope and fear as a transcendent, that ultimately the transcendent is the, if you will, the goal of spiritual practice. Hope, in its worldly manifestation, is a kind of glue. It's a form of desire. It's a thinking that the next moment will be better than this moment, somehow. And so we use hope to keep us glued to the world and to glued to the future, because we're all in a sense caught on this treadmill of day-to-day existence, and so whatever's going to make the next run of the treadmill a little sweeter than the current one is attractive to us. In the end it doesn't work, because as I said, you know, the thing you wanted will get rusted or ruined or lost or stolen or not satisfy in a certain way, and so you go for the next thing and the next thing. And our culture is based on that. It's based on providing the next thing and the next thing. When we were, you know, 2,000 years ago, you know, the next thing wasn't going to be an iPod or an iPhone. The next thing was you're going to get up and farm the land. You're going to go hunting, and hopefully there's a good crop. That's the next thing. You hope that the day will deliver something. But hope is the thing that keeps us in the wheel of life. The wheel of life keeps spinning based on fear and desire. Those are the two things that keep it going. And to get off the wheel is to, in a sense, everybody has their different interpretation of how you get off the wheel. But it, in some sense, my experience of what I'm going through at this point is you get off it by embracing it. Instead of fighting it, you go, this is the wheel. This is the wheel of life. This is what life is. And you start to enter into it rather than try to avoid it or try to deny its existence or see it as a bad thing. It is what it is. And then this thing happens internally. There's a kind of a shift from resisting life or even hating life for some people into accepting life and then embracing it, because it is what is. However it became what it is, somehow this attitudinal shift into I accept this, I open to this deeply, and there's something you call, it's a kind of release. It's a release from, not from suffering, because that's still there, but you go, oh, suffering. And it's not even from hope, because you go, I mean, you know, the iPod or the iPhone will come along and you go, oh, that'll be fun. But something in you knows it'll be fun for a minute, and you'll have it and you'll enjoy it for a minute, and then you'll put it behind you. It's a kind of awareness. It's just an awareness that this is how it works, this is what it is. And somehow in this deep embrace of that, that you stop fighting it, you stop resisting it, you stop expecting the unexpected or the thing that can't be delivered from it. You just go, this is it. And in that deep alignment with life, there comes about a kind of peace or openness. And then through that openness, there appears a portal into something transcendent. Something deeper and more profoundly alive than even life. And there it is. And it's somehow entered through the acceptance and not the resistance to and avoidance of life. But that acceptance is hard for people, because life seems on some level so painful, so unacceptable, so wrong. You know, it's not giving us the things we want. It's so full of suffering and pain, and yet the minute you go okay to that, it's a different world. It's the same world, but it's different. I don't know if that tallies with your Buddhist thinking, but that's it's my experience of it at this point. You know, and I don't know if that is enlightenment or if that is just conscious acceptance. I, you know, whatever it is, whatever name it has, it feels like a place worth arriving at internally. And that everyone can. And whether it goes even deeper than that, I suspect it does. And I suspect there are layers and layers and layers to the depth of that evolution. I think just stepping through that door is a big thing for human beings. The door of acceptance. Any other questions? Do you dare?
On this same theme, thinking about just the physical needs, and thinking, well, I hope that stuff grows in the garden, if I need to eat.
Right.
And, oh, well, you know, the locusts came. Or, and kind of dealing with the spiritual essence of what you're talking about, which feels very important, but then to let go, I guess I'm trying to square that with the sense of having physical needs and having desires. And,
yeah, the desire to survive is pretty big, you know, and life can frustrate that. You know, life is no pussycat. You know, it's a really intense experience for human beings. And it brings you into not philosophical dialogue with these things, but real existential dialogue. What do I do? The universe has not brought rain to my garden. I'm going to starve. My family is going to starve. There is real pain coming. And it's not just that. I mean, the world is full of horrible, horrible denial of our needs. You know, and I don't mean, you know, temporary casual. I mean, we're going to die. And then you have to take this practice and bring that into play. It won't be a philosophical practice. It won't even be a meditative practice. It will be a, this is me in this universe under these circumstances. Where is my salvation? Where is it? And as I've said to people in this class, because I think it's an important understanding, you know, when Christ was on the cross, he asked why he had been forsaken. So, I think a person whose garden hasn't grown and whose family is about to starve will probably ask the same question. And if you are the avatar of the last 2,000 years as Christ was in this world, and he asks that question, how can we not ask that question? And yet what happened for Christ was that within moments of that, it seems, I mean, the movies you see in the Bible, you know, he said, forgive those who have, I don't remember the words, but he asked for forgiveness for the people who have done this to him. And that compassion, that unbelievable compassion that emerged from him in that moment, indicates a kind of transition from being lost and abandoned and terrified and in unbearable suffering into something else. What is that movement that we go through, and that all human beings, I think, have to go through, which is ultimately feeling betrayed by life because it's going to be taken away from us. The one thing we want more than anything is survival and being, and then it's going to get taken away, and there's nobody in this room who's going to escape that. How do we, at that moment, deal with that? And the only way to deal with it, probably, is like any other human being, is to suffer it, and stay in perhaps a place of hope, you know, that this will lead to something, or just enter it. Enter it completely and go into oblivion and see where it goes. And the promise of someone like Christ or Buddha is that it turns into something else. It turns into something that, one that is, feels like compassion and feels like, I suspect, a deep embrace of existence. And we're going to be right or wrong. You know, the great teachers tell us that's where it happens. meanwhile, day to day, which is what we're living in now, we're not in the extreme moment right now. We're still, you know, some ways off, perhaps. I mean, you don't know. The extreme moment can come in a few seconds. But at this moment, we're not there. So what we are living in is a modicum of suffering and desire, somewhere in the middle of all that. And in the middle of all that, you can still practice this thing, which allows for a kind of deep equanimity that is joyful, simple, peaceful, and unbelievably alive. And feel life while you're here. Feel it now. Don't wait to feel it in those moments. Don't wait for the existential crises, because in a sense, every moment is an existential crisis that we pretend isn't. The reality is, this is it. This is it. Whatever this is all there is. And at one point, it's going to be gone. So let it be gone right now and see what happens internally. Make peace with it now and see what happens. I think it will transform the day-to-day life, and then the end game will be whatever that is, and we'll all figure that one out for ourselves, because there's nobody who's going to figure it out for us. You know, all my teachings, whatever I'm telling you, whatever Buddha tells you, whatever Christ tells you, or Moses tells you, they're going to be out the window so fast you won't even be able to remember that they told you anything, because it's going to be you and it. And then you either it's just one, or it's two. I mean, it's really, that's kind of what it comes down to. Either it's all about oneness, or it's about duality. And the promise, I think, of all of this teaching is there's only one. And if it's only one, it can't hurt itself. It's all, it's just one. Mm-hmm. Anyone else? Okay, have fun. Thank you all.